Yeah, absolutely. If it's done for comedic purposes, we keep it in. But, you know, ow.
Right.
Like that, for example, that'll be edited or put into the very front of the show. Yeah, just to indicate the monomaniacal pathos there, my whole family has to endure no air conditioning down here in near Burbank, California.
Well, as long as they're suffering for your art, I guess that's fine.
Oh.
Suffer.
They suffer for many reasons. Art among them. Now, you were saying you were sick?
As you may have heard, I went to GP Albuquerque last weekend, and yeah. I was cosplaying as Stitcher Gerolf, the greatest Skibaron of Innistrad. I was out late collecting components every evening in the graveyard, and unfortunately, that was a recipe for getting sick, getting ill. So if I sound like death, that's correct. Now, I don't normally get sick at conventions, but you see, on the way back, I had to go through two TSA checkpoints at San Diego. And
not sanitary.
No, well, I really wanted to double bag my feet in two pairs of socks. And since I didn't and had to go through those two checkpoints, I realized there was no afterlife, justice, or goodness in this world. So there was nothing left for me but to get ill.
And they won't let you wear the gloves or the apron through the checkpoint, will
no,
they?
No. I had to take off the cosplay, so I was utterly defenseless. There was no joy left. Now, I was also bitten by a vampire, but I'm sure that's just a coincidence. That's not the real problem. Have you noticed it's been especially bright in California the last few days? It must be. We're getting towards summer at this
point. Yeah, there's that big garlic festival in Gilroy.
I'm not sure. I don't think I'm going to go. I'm not feeling it this year.
Innistrad's tough.
It is a tough neighborhood, and you have to really do what you must in order to carve your place out in Innistrad history. No matter how many peasants complain, how the rabble they're so frightened of everything, especially, you know, 6-12 foot tall works of genius with seven arms. That frightens them, but a pretty face on an eight with angel wings, they found comfort in that for far too long, and the plane is paying the price due to their ignorance.
Yeah, it really is. And torches should be licensed, I think, at this point.
you need a background check to get a torch, for sure.
Minimum mandatory wait time?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Still can't take them through airport checkpoints.
No. Yeah. Not when they're lit anyways. You have to check those.
Do you have a speed lighter?
A speed lighter? No. In fact, as Stitcher Gerolf, I try to keep flame away from my scars at all possible, because their blood is... Well, I mean... No. I mean, actually, you'll have to edit this out, because it's definitely not true that the blood of scabs is 90% oil, which is highly flammable. No one needs to know that. And it's not true, because it's not true, that's why.
Yeah, that's why no one needs to know it.
Yeah, exactly so.
So you are a proponent of torch regulation.
Yes. In responsible hands only. Educated hands.
We try to stay away from politics on this show, but I think that's an important point to make. It's worth exposing our listeners to a little bit of politics.
Science must go on.
That's right.
No matter how, you know, some people get uncomfortable when Stitcher Gerolf digs up their relatives and uses them to advance the understanding of human knowledge, but frankly, soon they'll be dead too, and their corpses will be mine as well. So what does it really come to in that?
And what's better than having, like, an entire gallery of relatives serving you dinner every night?
Perhaps so. Especially Stitcher Gerolf's sister, Gisa, definitely should... She'd do a lot better as part of an abomination. She just doesn't do very well by herself at all. Yeah. Thinking is not her strong suit.
Right. And what I meant by an entire gallery was, of course, one creature that is an entire family, or former family. Because I, you know, we're having you on the show and not Gisa.
Well, I don't know what Gisa would not spend the time talking to people. I think she'd just be dancing, frolicking around graveyards with her little undead doll posse, her little party of flesh mannequins. It's so sad. The issue is Gerolf and Gisa are twins, and... unfortunately, the umbilical cord was wrapped around her head when it was a baby, and as a result, she can only make two zombies. It's such a tragic story.
Yeah. And so she was kind of, you know, deprived of oxygen for a little bit?
Yes.
Oh, no wonder.
Yeah, it just explains so much, really. I, as Stitcher Gerald, have offered her a brain transplant multiple times, and she's refused every time. Can you believe it? Even though it's clearly indicated.
Well, you know, what is she holding on to there?
Just probably her delirious enjoyment of dancing with corpses. I think that's probably the main thing. So I've been doing well, in other words.
Okay, that's good. That's good. We can go on like this for hours, I think. But I think what we'll do is start the show soon.
Sounds fair.
I'm Phil DeLuca.
I'm Nate Burgess.
And Sean can't be with us this time. And we are Commanderin. And now we insert some music. We have lots of music. It's fun. Commanderin. Thanks for listening, everybody. We focus on topics the community wants to hear about and talk to interesting people along the way, don't we, Nate?
Yep.
But we never, ever talk about three banned topics: religion, politics, and Hearthstone. You can find us on all the social medias by searching for Commanderin MTG Podcast. This week, we have a wonderful show lined up for you. We have a visitor who is the Stitcher of Words, the plague of TSA checkpoints, A.E. Marling.
Greetings. Thank you for having me. I have appeared on the Magic the Gathering Mothership a few times as Stitcher Gerolf. I enjoy cosplaying and showing people the error of their ways following Avacyn. I think they've all learned their lesson at this point. This is what happens when you blindly follow winged aliens and send rabble with torches after those who are trying to advance science and make the world a better place. So
that's right.
I think people have learned their lesson with Avacyn at this point.
That's right. Many people fear those who delve into the very secrets, the fabric of reality.
They do fear what they don't understand, and since mm-hmm. people hardly understand anything, it's a sorry existence indeed.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. It's a real pleasure. We've been chatting already, and it's wonderful, and I think we're going to have a blast. And we met, the three of us actually met at GP Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Was a pleasure, yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that it's taken this long to invite you on the show and have you on. I'm sorry that we've been so lazy.
We are going to be at GP LA as well, so yes. We should be able to get some Commander games in there.
Yes. What are you going to be running at GP LA?
Well, I probably will be cosplaying as Stitcher Gerolf again, so I'll want to bring mm-hmm. that deck, Grim Corpseborn, and we'll talk about that more later. But I also did get the final promo washout piece to my Sea Monsters tribal deck, so I'll be playing that as well.
Excellent. And that's the final piece that you needed?
Well, yes. The final piece, the moons have aligned, and now the tide will be unstoppable, yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very in theme as well, sir.
Well, I am a level 20 flavor judge. So. Now, part of that entails, I have played Magic for over 20 years, and then I got a written letter of recommendation for Grand Arbiter Augustin the Fourth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Most of those 20 years, I was playing competitive Magic. I did some casual formats as well, but just a few years ago, so after I've been playing for 20 years, I looked at this Commander format, and I'm like, well, this will be interesting, this will be new. So I decided I would try that, and one of my first experiences, this podcast, I am interested in talking about the importance of fun and casual, and this story is relevant to that. But one of my first experiences with Commander was highly negative, and I almost stopped before I started at all. My plan was to play Xenagod, the Xenagos, the god of revels, and let's see, I can read that card soon, but basically, he doubles the power of one attacking creature, and he gives him haste. So it makes the combat phase relative are relevant in a format which is often populated by board wraths and discourages winning through combat damage, or at least through non-commander combat damage. But yeah, so Xenic Ghost, God Rebels, three generic, red-green, indestructible, legendary enchantment creature. If you have enough devotion, he turns into a creature, but I tend not to pursue that. At the beginning of your combat, on your turn, another target creature you control gains haste and gets plus X until on a turn, where X is that creature's power. Now, I thought this would be great fun, because I could finally make these, my favorite draft on rare dragons, hydras and such, that I'd played throughout the years relevant again, and I can actually crush people and devour them whole. So this was just, I was just delighted, just rubbing my hands, and I was telling someone about this at my local commander shop. And this is basically a direct quote, because I remember, and this is what he said. "Well, first of all, you're wrong. The only choice for gruel colors is Wart, the Raid Mother." So let's see. Let me load up Wart here, okay, so I can read
the only stuff. Choice.
The only choice. This is. He's like, "I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're just wrong." Wart, the Raid Mother. She costs 6, and she comes to play with 2/2 goblins, and then all your instants and sorceries from there on out have Conspire, which means you can copy them if you tap some creatures. Mm-hmm. And now, I knew essentially that he was being an arrogant ass, because I've been playing for 20 years, and I understood a few things. First of all, I understood what made this deck fun to me, and that was attacking with large, giant monsters and just eating people alive. And clearly, Wart isn't meeting my goals, because I had a good understanding of the fun philosophy. I was able to distance myself from his really hurtful argument. And as I said, it could have made me stop playing Commander right then. I'm like, well, if the one thing I want to do in this fun game I can't even do, what's the point of playing it? So Imagine if I had been just a new player coming to Magic for the first time, or maybe I've been playing kitchen tables, and I decide, okay, finally I've built this deck. I'd almost completed it at that point. Or I say I was going to start building it. And then someone had just commented and told me that I was just completely wrong. And that, in fact, there was only one correct choice for Gruul, Wart the Raid Mother. A commander, by the way, I have actually never seen played, by the way. But just imagine if I had been a new player and didn't have this kind of wealth of Magic experience, I might have believed him. And that would have been a very harmful thing. If I had, in fact, built Wart instead, I might have been unhappy with the deck. Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't have had as much fun. And my horizons would have been restricted. But given my experience, I knew he was just being a ridiculous fool. And I built the deck, and, you know, it worked as planned. The Hydras and Titans romp around in the Xenagos' grand party, and it was great fun. But it comes down to our goals. He wasn't necessarily incorrect, but his goal, his fun philosophy, as it were, was to gain incremental advantages off the sorceries and instants he cast, perhaps because he found that those spells, those non-creature elements, tended to be more strong in Commander, and I think that may be true. Or it could be that his fun philosophy was simply that he believed winning was the most fun for him, that the most powerful cards were the best, and he believed that Wart was in fact stronger overall than Xenagod. And I'm not even sure that's true. But fundamentally, we had different ideas of, we had different goals and what I'll call different fun philosophies. Because I do encourage everyone to create their own fun philosophy for their deck, to look at their deck and decide, you know, what makes this commander special? What makes this deck really delight me? What makes this fun? And once you identify that, and I, since I'm a writer, I always write these things out. Once you've written that out, you can then go through the list and say, you know what? Maybe this card doesn't quite work into that fun philosophy. Or at the very least, you can become aware of it and understand why you're enjoying what you're doing and allow yourself to engage in that. Allow yourself to just, when you play that, let's see, what's that new Hydra? Ulvenwald Hydra. Search up a strip mine to get rid of the opponent's Maze of Ith, and then you attack for 12 or 15 in the next turn. Maybe that's a bad example, but you search up for, let's see.
The strip mine Maze of Ith is a good combination.
Yeah, but you can't hit him immediately. That's why the example was no good. But there's an avatar. Let's see. There you go. You search up your avatar of slaughter. It has double strike. You double it to 16, so you hit someone for 32 damage and kill them instantly. So and then once you do that, you just really get into it. And, you know, you might want to keep the gloating to a minimum if they're not the last opponent, because then people can get salty. But in the inside, you're like, yes. Yep. Yes. Yep.
So did you identify as a Timmy player on the Timmy Johnny Spike spectrum?
No, mainly I am a Spike, to be honest. And I also am interested in a lot of the Vorthos elements, and we'll be talking about flavor and such. But throughout most of my Magic career, I have identified as a Spike. And now, I'm not as spiky as the spikiest, and so I'm like 70% Spike, 30% Vorthos. And when I'm building this deck, this Xenagod deck, I thought it was, you know, it was a spiky thing I could do in the context of my Vorthos desires. And the strategy, now I do create a second, there's a fun philosophy, and then there's a battle strategy. And the battle strategy for the Xenagod deck is different. It is every creature, when it comes into play, if it costs four or more, it has to kill the opponent, or it has to interact with the opponent in some way. So and that affects the creature that I've chosen. So those are two different things, and I combine both those requirements when searching for cards to put in my deck. And there are just so many cards in Magic that you can find ones which fulfill both deck building needs, the fun and the battle strategy. Now,
yes, absolutely.
I've listened to a bunch of Commander podcasts, and I read the articles, and primarily the thing which I feel is not talked about enough is this fun philosophy. And it's possible that it's more distinct in my mind because I came to Commander after playing a lot of competitive formats. And the distinction in my mind is very clear that I'm doing something which, because I'm just enjoying it. I'm not doing it for points. I'm not necessarily doing it to win anything. If I win the game, that's good, but I don't get a match slip. So I get to decide. I can decide if I've won on multiple levels. I could win by killing everyone else. I can win by playing an awesome deck. I can win by achieving any number of fun things that my deck can do. Sometimes I can win just by killing a single other person if he's being a dick, especially that guy who told me that Xenagod is the wrong answer. You better believe that I killed him first. and also, as a corollary to that, when people are talking about cards, and whenever we go to a new set, it's exciting when we get to see these new fun cards which are powerful. And when we play them, they have a huge impact on the board, like Uvenwald Hydra. I think it's an exciting one to the new set. And that's going into my Xenagod deck, because you can search up Strip Mine or the Wolf Run, and Kessick Wolf Run. And that is an exciting card because it's powerful, but also I have to keep in mind that it's exciting also because I just love attacking because of my fun philosophy, because I want to attack with these huge bomb, draft bomb fatties. And I think the concept of what card is fun is not talked about enough in the Commander community, and to the point where it's scarcely talked about at all. And we mainly focus on power, and I think part of that is because the fun philosophy is going to differ from person to person and from deck to deck. So it is a little bit more difficult to talk about, but I think when I'm building these decks, it's the most important element when I choose which card to play. And I think, as a corollary to this, the language we use to talk about Commander cards needs to be leavened. It can't be absolute. When we say, what if I said, okay, this Uvenwald Hydra, perhaps you might have been able to infer what it does at this point, but it's a star Hydra, power and toughness equal to the number of lands you control, and you get to search for a land. It's a fair primeval titan. Yeah. And what if I said, well, every green deck needs to play Uvenwald Hydra? And the bottom line is I'm getting a little bit carried away. It's a good card, but what if I saying every deck must play a card or needs to play a card is just frankly factually not correct. Even if it was Primeval Titan, I wouldn't need to play it in all my green decks. Certainly it would be powerful, it would be very strong, but Commander isn't necessarily about playing the strongest cards. I would suggest thinking about Commander as a tabletop game of politics, which happens to use magic cards. Now, you can play with strong cards, or you can play with weaker cards and use those cards to have make a political statement saying, well, I'm not playing with Primeval Titan or Ulvenwald Hydra, because clearly those are the best cards,
right.
But I'm playing with this fun green creature, which is a little bit wonky that you've never seen before, and which may nonetheless be strong in my deck strategy. And even if it's not strong on any metric, just the fact that I'm playing wonky green creatures, just kind of whimsical green creatures, will make me less of a target, and will make me able to perhaps position myself politically that I can win a game which my cards themselves, I can win a game against more powerful cards. You can play with worse cards in Commander, which you nonetheless enjoy and which have more fun playing, and still win games. But
oh,
even
absolutely.
If you don't win games. Now, it is true that after talking about my Xenagod deck, it wins about a quarter of its matches, and that's fine.
Yeah, that's great.
For a four-person game. Now, there are strategies that I play in EDH which are more strong than that, which are more robust, and they feel like they win over half the games of four-player games, which is just ridiculous. But I can't say you need to play those cards, because they're not even necessarily more fun. Those strategies, they almost feel a little dirty. And since Commander, it's about having, it's a casual format, and what are you doing if you're not having fun? And I'm not sure I actually have more fun playing these stronger strategies, which tend to win more.
See, this concept resonates with us very strongly. Nate is a master of putting together absolutely fun decks, and you may have heard it on the Christmas episode with Nate's Grenzo deck.
Excellent.
Or Thanksgiving with Nate's Derevi Turkey Tribal, Bird Tribal deck. And these are very fun decks that are very effective. Nate also has a, how do we pronounce it, Nate? Nath?
Yeah, Nath of the Gilt Leaf, Elf Tribal.
These decks all play cards that we look at and we go, what the heck is this thing? And then he proceeds, you know, to play to the theme and kick our teeth in, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of value to be gained by being defeated by a card you've never seen before.
Right, yeah. And so Nate is kind of the master of this. We have an online playtest group, our online meta, if you will, that has a bunch of players all across the spectrum, some spiky ones, some really, really kind of timmy ones. I'm kind of one of the timmy ones. And Nate is known for producing horribly lethal decks that play to a theme and are always entertaining. And one of Nate's specialties is, you know, he figures out a way and often holds back until he can kill everybody all at once.
That is a strong commander strategy.
Well, with the theme, right? Not just like, oh, I'm going to fireball everybody or whatever, but just if it's in theme, he manages to do it. And it's glorious. And yeah, so we are very familiar with that and often play what the community will refer to as janky decks.
Mm-hmm. That is why I wanted to talk about this on your podcast. So thank you for having me. And
excellent. Well, yeah, it's a great fit. When I saw your Sea Monsters deck in Vegas, I was like, my first thought was, what is he doing? Because the Sea Monsters typically used are not that effective, but they're, or individually are not that effective, but the way you were combining it, and you had a reputation in that hall already for playing like what amounts to a super janky, super effective deck.
So, let's see. I play Thassa, God of the Sea, as that commander, and
right.
That fun philosophy is simply that all the creatures need to be fearsome, loathsome, terrifying, beautiful sea monsters. And then the deck strategy, it's basically as weak as you could possibly have a deck. I mean, that deck is very weak on a fundamental level, because you're committing multiple creatures to the board, all of which are pretty terrible. I even play Marjan, which is I usually add one incredibly weak sea monster to the deck at a time. So I play Marjan, which is a 8/8 for 7, and you have to sacrifice another creature to untap it or something like that. But
yeah.
It is nonetheless one of the most terrifying sea monsters around. That's spelled Marjen or something like that. But so my the deck's strategy, the battle strategy, is to deploy these sea monsters, draw a bunch of cards, as blue does, and then counter the board wraths, and maybe bounce opponent's creatures with Whelming Wave or something like that. But anyways, so the strategy is actually, I compensate for the bad creatures with some very strong blue strategy in terms of draw cards. And so the deck actually does win probably about 25% of the games, or it feels very close to winning quite frequently as well. So the deck is fun.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to playing against it.
Have you added Thing in the Ice?
No, because actually the deck doesn't have enough sorceries and instants in it. Very few, actually. So it is mainly just full of sea monsters. Although that card is very good in Modern. I've been testing that the last few days. I think it's well worth its $10 price point.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be taking off in Modern. There are so many decks that rely on instants and sorceries. I think Thing fits well, for example, into a Mizzix deck.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
So another thing I wanted to talk about in terms of the importance of fun. I have had some pushback in the Commander community when I talk about playing weaker cards for the purposes of, for other purposes. I wrote an article about Pain Lands are better than Dual Lands and on Gathering Magic. And there was a lot of pushback on that article. Now, I was a little bit hyperbolic in my... Well, actually, I don't think I even went far enough in terms
of... No, I don't think you did. I read that article when you posted it.
But I think it's important that this concept of playing something weaker just because you've enjoyed is not actually unique to that article or to even casual formats in general. If you talk to pro players, such as pro players who frequently advise you to play the deck you like playing rather than perhaps the best deck, because if you enjoy playing a deck, you're going to learn more. That's what Valentin Mackel said. Jeff Hoogland played Kiki Pod even during Eldrazi Winter. Let's see. Hall of Famer Willie Eldell played a Jund during Eldrazi Winter, and they innovated, and they gained, and even in those very competitive formats where the better cards are strictly better every time, the most powerful cards are strictly better every time. There's no political elements in one versus one. They nonetheless gained strategic advantages. People didn't necessarily know what they were doing. They were playing an off-the-road strategy. And I get some of that when I play Slivers in Modern. And by playing these strategies which you love, which are uncommon, you gain strategic advantage in all of Magic. And you gain political advantage on top of that in multiplayer formats. So I feel that Commander players are just really excited about powerful cards, but they also, I encourage them to feel excited and joyful about cards which may not necessarily be powerful, which may have an interesting flavor element they enjoy, or just be a card that they delight in playing. So there are a lot of reasons that you can be fun and excited about cards in this format, and power is only one of them, and I would suggest it's in fact not one of the more important elements in the format.
Yeah, we completely agree with you. I think it's important to find that balance between what is fun and what is effective, and make sure that you're also playing to a theme, especially in Commander. You can play good stuff decks, and good stuff decks are generally composed of the most effective cards in their, you know, in their particular role. But the real challenge is in finding good stuff that fits the theme and entertains. We have a card actually we're going to talk about, because I think you mentioned it in your Pain Lands are Better Than Dual Lands article, that can be entertaining, but usually only to the person who's playing it.
which card is that?
Well, so we have a segment on the show that we call The Watch List. And these are cards, generally speaking, that kind of warp the meta and warp the game that they're played in. Wonderful cards like our departed friend, Prophet of Kruphix, and a few other noteworthy ones, including Deadeye Navigator and so forth, that aren't yet banned, around which the game revolves and attempts to control it or eliminate it or copy it and so forth. Like, the games just sort of degenerate into those. And the card that we're talking about this time, Nate selected Sensei's Divining Top.
I have a quote here. If someone plays annoyances like these, I'll attack that player on principle.
Oh, yeah.
In Commander, we have to think of a card's perceived power. Multiplayer is a game of politics that just happens to use magic cards, and that's great.
Who said that, mate?
Oh, that was A.E. Marlin. Pain lands are better than duels.
He knows his stuff. He knows his stuff. Very consistent speaker. But, yeah, I, and this is an example of some people objected to this. They're like, well, I'm just spinning my divine top, but clearly this other person, that's a ridiculous reason to attack me just because I'm doing this, and someone else might have something stronger. But that's clearly not what I'm talking about. If someone else has a consecrated sphinx in play, I'm attacking that person or I'm killing that sphinx first. But if, in situations where the boards are equal and you're spinning your divining top, that says to me, well, wait a minute. This guy is, now, perhaps if there's it's an artifact-based deck, but even then, this is a card I'm very familiar with in Legacy. And I am content with it in Legacy, because that's a format where you just absolutely do the most powerful things, no matter what, and people get very good at spinning their top. But in Commander, you know what? Playing Divining Top says something very specific about your deck, and that is you're willing to play cards which give you very incremental advantages, and that you're searching your deck a lot with fetch lands or with tutors. And both those things I'm not necessarily too keen on. So yes, I will attack. All else being equal, I'll definitely attack the person who has Divining Top, because it says something about their deck and their stance on power gaming, I would say. And
you hear that, Phil?
Well, I was just going to say, don't hate the player for playing a Divining Top. Try to hate the Divining Top.
That's true, but I'll still kill the person whose hand is on the Divining Top. No, I have no doubt. So now, by the other hand, what if some people just love their Divining Tops. So you know what? So you'll have to pitch that to me politically in a way which you'll have to make that into a political point. Like, you'll need to use your policy and say, well, you know what, I'm not doing anything too powerful with it. I'm like, but you're kind of spinning your top every turn. I that would be a tough one to sell to me politically. Because again, I play Legacy, and that card is just ridiculously strong. But also, and this is a card which I've heard people say that it should be in every deck. And whenever someone says, it must be in every deck, whenever someone says that, that puts my teeth on edge in Commander, because I feel it's strictly not true. I play Slivers in Commander, and this is something.
This is coming from the guy who introduced us to Miri's Guile.
So I play Slivers in Commander, and I've heard a lot of Slivers players says, well, the Commander you must have to absolutely need to play is Sliver Overlord, if I remember that correctly. The one which allows you to search for any sliver by paying 3.
Right. That's a truism.
They say you absolutely have to play this Commander, and that's just, you know what, that's not true. You can develop a different strategy if you don't like the idea of searching every turn and wasting everyone's time like that. Then you can play something else. And just any absolute state in Commander, I would suggest being skeptical of that.
Yeah, but with Slivers, you're searching for exactly a specific sequence of Slivers.
Well, people assume, yeah, the thing with Slivers is people assume you're going to do something heinously unforgivable every turn. So,
yeah,
I would say Sliver Overlord, and that's true. That's true. But it's even more obvious with Sliver Overlord, and I don't think that's necessarily a strategy that you have to have. But no, that's an entirely different subject. Trying to win a Sliver is a different conversation, unto itself.
Yeah, you had Sliver Legions?
No.
Is that what you had?
Sliver Legion is even worse, because people can see what's going to happen. You play a sliver every turn, and slivers incrementally get stronger. And that's a harder thing to pitch politically. So anyways, in case anyone hasn't played against slivers before, haven't tried to play slivers, everyone attacks and tries to destroy the sliver player first, typically because the strategy is obvious. And it's just, every card you play, you're going to get more and more unstoppable. So an easy way to stop that is just by killing their creatures or attacking them first. And it's a very hard thing to do pitched politically. One person asked me, you asked for questions. People ask questions for this podcast. And one person asked me what sort of stories I tell when playing Commander. And typically, the story I tell is that I'm not doing anything strong. Like, trust me, when I'm playing Grim Grimm's Corpseborn, I'm just doing this for science. What I'm doing is just, you know, for the benefit of all and for research. It's not anything to be worried about. And frankly, you're wrong to attack me and inhibiting me. So whenever I tell a story in Commander, it's essentially that what I'm doing is not strong, and that you should be embarrassed and sorrowful at yourself and guilty for attacking me. When clearly what I'm doing is not a problem. And when I'm playing a card, and that doesn't mesh very well with a card like Sliver Legion, where you can clearly see that not only what I'm doing is a problem, is I'm probably going to kill multiple people a turn based on commander and non-commander damage with this ridiculous commander. So anyways, that's a spicy
Sliver Legion, among Sliver commanders, Sliver Legion is probably the least offensive of them. Right, the Overlord goes and fetches the sliver that makes all slivers indestructible.
It's true. It fetches Sliver Legion.
it does. It fetches Sliver Legion. But Sliver Legion is sort of like the last thing you fetch before you go kill the entire board.
I think that this is another interesting subject. I've had more success with Commander decks, and I think it's a better strategy overall to hide your strength to make your strength kind of in hand or in your deck. So in that sense, I think actually Sliver Legion is the most obvious and the easiest to see, to visualize the progression of that strength. Like, anyone can see that things are going to get progressively worse. Whereas, true, Sliver Overlord can fetch Sliver Legion, but you kind of have to make that cognitive jump on some level. And now, people who've played against Slivers before, that's still not a hard jump to make. But in general, I feel that it's better to... this is not me advocating searching for cards, necessarily, but just... So, that's the thing. I did play for a while in my Sea Monsters deck. I do have Thought of Adele, actually. I do play that card. As two pips for devotion, and it's a... I've got a sweet altar for her. I have a Little Mermaid altar for her, but... the issue is she's searching everyone's deck every turn, and it's not like a quick search, because I actually do have to usually look for, if not their soul ring, then something. And that's just like the most annoying effect. And it feels so dirty when you're to have your deck rifled through. And speaking of that, I did cast, I forgot the card name. I took it out. I put Thassa, God of the Sea back, because it's very strong, but just searching every turn, it's not necessarily when you're searching for specific strong, it's a very strong effect, of course. But on the other hand, why are we pursuing consistency in a casual format, which is really, in my mind, fun because of its diversity and fun because of its inherent randomness? I want to see new combinations, new exciting things I've never seen before. Whereas if I'm winning with, you know, an infinite sliver combo every time, well, how fun does that get to be?
Disgusting.
Now, I do play some fetch lands. I do play some search cards, such as, we can talk about Grimgrim. I do play some Entomb style effects, some search style effects, but you have to kind of be aware that maybe reducing the diversity of the format, since you're searching for the same cards, and also maybe leading to repetitive games.
Maybe if you're playing Thought of Adele, it's because your play group enjoys that feeling of being robbed. and they all want to take a break, maybe every turn, take a break, go get some soda, go get some food, go to the bathroom while you're robbing them or robbing somebody else at the table.
So what you're saying is when I'm Sister Geralf, the corpses really want to be stolen. And they want to be stitched together in these just towering works of genius. You know what? And you are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. They do want that. They want to be repurposed and used to a greater whole. You know, thanks for clarifying that for me.
No one wants to lie in a pile of dirt for all of eternity. No.
When they could be put to good use for science? No.
That's just wasteful.
Yeah. I mean, if you can benefit all of your species by your remains being used for science, of course, who wouldn't choose that?
Indeed. Well, I think this is a good time to kind of segue into my Grim Corpse Bone deck, which I did play at GP Albuquerque. And the fun philosophy was that everything had to be very flavorfully in tune with Innistrad.
Having too much fun.
Either coming from the set itself, the Innistrad sets themselves, or matching the kind of gothic horror theme. And also, someone asked if I play Sitra Gerolf as my commander. I do not, for various reasons, but he's a great addition to this Grim deck, and I play him and I guess I have to play my sister Gisa as well. I mean, I don't really want to, but it is flavorfully appropriate that she be there, and Grim was named after her face. Like all things, it was improved by science. So anyways, I can share a few fun experiences from GP Albuquerque.
Wait. Her face... She's named Gisa because of her face?
No. Grimgrim is named after her face.
Oh, her face. Got it.
Wait, what?
Grimgrim, the corpse-born, legendary zombie, and one of the greatest works of Sitra Gerolf, was named after his sister Gisa's face. That is true.
I thought it was because he had a bear trap for a face.
Well,
Two are related.
Look, in order to emulate what Gerolf sees in his sister's face, he needed a bear trap.
Yes.
So, in GP Albuquerque, I did have a few fun moments. And so I did have this rather stringent deck requirement that things had to match the theme. And I've been a long time, and I think I've got the deck pretty close. So that means I'm not playing some of the cards that you normally otherwise play in Grimgrim, such as, if I can remember any card names, the 2/2 Vampire, which comes back into play whenever you play a land, Bloodghast. Very good, because it's a free thing which you can get every turn and use it to untap Grimgrim. I'm actually not playing that card because it's a Vampire Spirit, and I didn't really see why Grimgrim or the Sitra Gerolf and his sister would be reanimating it, and it's a Zendikar card.
But you do play Gravecrawler, right?
I do play Gravecrawler. Because
that's on theme.
It is on theme. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So, a few highlights from GP Albuquerque. I put down Glaring Spotlight, which allowed me to target Sigarda, the original Sigarda, who has hexproof, and Grimgrim plucked off her wings and attached them to his own body for science, and I killed that player. And then, let's see, at one point I had put myself into play, Sitra Gerolf, and with intention of using his ability to create a zombie token next turn to untap Grimgrim. However, someone attacked me with a Leviathan, as it turned out. Oh, the humanity. So I put everything into science. I sacrificed everything for science and sacrificed Sitra Gerolf himself to untap Grimgrim and block the Leviathan. So I want you to know that I put everything into my research. And then
that's good to hear.
Then I killed Avacyn and reanimated her multiple times. Now, clearly, I didn't kill Avacyn with Grimgrim, but I have cards like Fleshbag Marauder, who definitely kills Avacyn. And I will be sending the link to the deck, and I'm sure, Commander, you can put it in the show notes.
Yes, we absolutely will. We may already have a link to it, I think, at least the pre-SOI version.
We have the Key to Casual article on Gathering Magic, and it has your deck list in there?
The link will have the updates with the Shadows of Innistrad cards. And my
All right.
I became more attuned to flavor. Or I had, at this point, enough resources to be more correct and precise on flavor. And Nate, I wanted to commend you for your Kalidus zombie tribal deck. A lot of good food for thought in that one.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Siphon Flesh. Helldozer. Helldozer particularly strong because there's a lot of lands, which Grimgrim doesn't like.
Problematic.
Yeah. Such as Maze of If. Ugh. Who does that?
Sorry. Maze of If is wonderful.
No, it is. It is. I play it in one of my decks, too. But, like, I guess my Sea Monster deck doesn't care because it doesn't attack with any one good creature.
Wait, did you say you play it in all of your decks?
I play Maze of If in one of my decks, and then I play ways to deal with Maze of If in all my decks. But Sea Monsters. Because, as I said, Sea Monsters doesn't have any one good creature which you care about connecting, because none of those creatures are good. But most of my strategies involve walloping someone with a single large creature, often the commander.
Yeah, so you need to get around the Maze of If and a couple of other problematic cards like that. But Sea Monsters, you assemble a flotilla, don't you?
Yes, I do. An armada beneath the waves.
Ooh.
That deck's a delight. Awesome. Yeah, I look forward to playing that again.
So the question you referenced before was from Dirkoke XXL. He was the one who was asking about stories and how you tell stories in a 100-card singleton format. And you clearly have mastered this.
Well, I aspire to be even greater. Politics is something which I have embraced it as part of Commander, and that is the main difference between other forms of Magic and multiplayer. And if you're encouraging someone to try Commander, try multiplayer, who's done other sorts of Magic, or they're starting again, do emphasize, just do pitch it for what it is, a game of politics. And again, a good story, good narrative can be part of that.
Oh, I fully agree. For some of the more, let's say, mechanical tips, have you listened to Josh Lee Kwai on the Command Zone? They have a Politricks and Tips episode that he doesn't reveal all of his secrets because we've played together, of course. And I think you managed to play against him at Vegas, didn't you?
You know what? I don't think I actually managed to play against him, but I play against most everyone else.
Oh, got it. Right. We didn't have a chance to tilt either, so it'd be fun to be part of a group with you.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. I do recommend a Command Zone for the politics episodes. Definitely teach the kind of the finesse to it.
Yeah. And it's fun. It's fun putting some of these. So I recognize a bunch of the same tricks that he uses, because you don't ever want to call attention to yourself or make it obvious that you're doing any kind of a political maneuver. Like you're engaging in politics at all. But little side comments like, wow, I wish I had that card, or man, that's a powerful card.
Yeah, that sort of finesse is definitely the next level. And that is what I need to work on. Sometimes I will definitely say, like, well, that person plays Rhystic Study. That's definitely the most powerful card on the board. Or sometimes I'll just say, this may be going a bit too far. See, this is the finesse, which I may not have yet. But if someone says Rhystic Study, mostly the first thing I say is, oh, I guess you want to die first. And I'll just... or if someone plays Turn 1 Soul Ring, and I'll say, I guess we now know who the villain is. And that is true. I think Sol Ring is an interesting card in Commander, because if you play first one turn Sol Ring, you have an immense villainous advantage over the rest of the table, and if there's no other Sol Rings. And it does almost feel like, at that point, a game of arch enemy. And it is important that people ally against the person with Sol Ring. And because they have what feels like an unfair mana resource advantage, and they can just be two turns ahead of everyone else, if not more. And that's an interesting dynamic to Commander. And at first I didn't understand, because Sol Ring is by far the strongest card in Commander. I didn't understand why it wasn't banned. But I think it does add an interesting dynamic now. But I will say that if you wish to not be the villain of the Commander table, maybe hold off playing that Sol Ring until turn 3 or so.
I have actually started sandbagging Sol Rings. Because too many times it'll be like, land Sol Ring Signet, or you know, boots or something like that. And that does, it draws way too much attention. And so even a second turn Solvering, really, yeah, you're still ahead, but now it's not as egregious as it was before.
It depends what your goal is for that game. Sometimes I tend not to play decks which can kind of run away with the game, but I have played against some decks where they really are just, they're like, well, I'm going to be the villain, but what I'm doing is so much stronger, and you might not be able to interact with it very well.
Perforos.
Could be Perforos, I suppose. Maybe Krenko. Something like that, where you kind of just, I'm going to be the villain anyways. Here I go. This is my one shot, and I'm taking it.
Yeah.
Yeah, from what I've gathered, a lot of the finesse of politics is the art of pretending your own board state is terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nate has been practicing that recently.
And that's what I use more than anything else. Especially the deck. I mean, that Sea Monsters deck. It's not hard to convince people that my board is terrible. Because it is. But again, kind of what makes it strong is in my hand, because it's the draw cards and the sneaky counter spells. But yeah, that's the strategy I tend to use. And that strategy is more important than any specific card I use in those decks.
Well, fellow writer Bruce Richard plays a Creatures from the Briny Deep deck, has Prime Speaker Zagana as the commander, so that he can dip into green and pull all sorts of green and blue horrors out.
I do like that. It makes a lot of sense. I've felt remiss not being able to play Thassa. Wait, no, not Thassa, but Kiora.
Oh, yeah.
Now, like any Planeswalker, not the best, but... just her ultimates are so flavorful. Yeah, I just want to believe. I just want to dream. I just want to dream of Leviathans crashing in and just drowning everything. Is that so wrong?
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, thanks. Thanks. You're true friends.
But we asked him if he plays Segovian Leviathan, so we kind of have to ask you, do you play Segovian Leviathan?
That would be one of the more ridiculous creatures ever printed. Am I remembering correctly? Segovian, that's a 3-3?
Yeah. 3-3 Leviathan.
In other words, not really a Leviathan.
Right, but do you play it?
I don't play it because I could maybe play it based on the art. So just if I had played that card a lot previously, I could see like an emotional attachment to draw it to me. But I don't actually play it because it only has one pip on it, and it doesn't really help Thassa very much. And there's so many other cards I could be playing, such as that slot is full of, you know, fun Dan, for instance, the 2-pip 4/1 creature which attacks very aggressively. That's sort of the sort of card I play in that deck. But you are correct that Segovian Leviathan would be a fun choice just based on hilarity.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can pretend it's a baby Leviathan.
I play Manta Ray sometimes. It's a 3-3 for 2 pips and a generic.
You really care about the pips. Are you bringing Thassa online a lot?
I do. She does. She is part of the host, which kind of makes the deck work like that. Just +5 power, whether or not she kills someone on commander damage. But just that +5 power actually does make the deck aggressive enough to be able to do something anyways.
It's a trade-off, right?
Yeah, on the one side, this beautiful briny flavor. On the other, terrible, terrible cards.
Yeah. You play, I forget, what's the name of the card, Nate, that removes, sends all creatures back to their owner's hands unless it's a Kraken Leviathan or a serpent?
Whelming Wave. Sorry, I had to say it. Yeah. Key card in the deck.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Segovian Leviathan. What were they thinking? With scale whales, and then they had to retcon that. It's, oh, well, Segovia, everything is miniature.
That... one of the more baffling artistic choices in the game.
Well, you know, it was huge at the time, right? No.
No, it wasn't ever.
No.
It was talked about at the time.
Do you play Sea Serpent?
Sea Serpent, no. Well, I mean...
Oh, 5/5 Island Walker?
Yeah, okay. It was relevant when I was... Okay, well, there's a story inherent to this. those cards were relevant when I just first started playing Magic cards, and there's a card called Island Fish Jaconis.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a 6/8... island home creature, and you to untap it, you had to pay only 3 blue during your upkeep, or maybe it was tapped if you didn't play 3 blue. And that was just my favorite card ever. And my friend gave me this card, and I was just delighted. And then he decided he wanted it back because he realized how good it was. And I wouldn't give it to him. So we're not friends anymore, but I still have the card, so happy ending.
I lost a friend, kept a card. Yeah. Happy ending. That's great.
Fair trade. Well, look, he wasn't very intelligent if he gave me.
The island fish Jasconius.
Yeah, we were both 10th time or 7th. Mm-hmm.
Well, who needs friends?
You know what? Who needs friends without giant fins, you know?
That's right. That's right. You've got all the fishy friends you need. And undead friends. Hey, do all your friends smell bad?
Your first mistake was smelling. That's really on you. That's on you. That's on you. Now, there were a few, if I may, there were a few questions that people asked me on Twitter for this episode.
Yes. Yes, and we have them sort of interspersed through the show notes, but as I just tweeted to our $10 patrons, we lost control of the episode.
Well,
and it's great.
It occurs to me that I haven't seen the high rate questions. Do you have questions that the patrons have asked?
The patrons were somewhat silent this time around. For those interested in how the Patreon system works with Commander, and we gave the $10 patrons, which we have an ongoing Facebook chat with, 2 days notice of your arrival. I think I let you know that we were telling them. And then all of the other patrons had a 1 day notice. And then Twitter basically got, you know, a little bit yesterday. But of course, Twitter having a far larger audience, we got many more questions from them. And we had some really good comments like, oh, wow, I can't wait to hear this. This is going to be a great episode. And when I mentioned this to them, that we lost control of the episode, they were like, oh, this sounds fantastic. So Hunter and Bradford and Jackie and Robin and all those other folks, I know at least one of them is watching right now in the show notes, too.
Very good. Well, yes. So one question that, let's see, that Chris Longton asked on Twitter, he said, he had two questions, actually. Do I have a pet card? And I think, actually, my pet card is Pyroblast / Red Elemental Blast. Because I feel that these are the lightning bolts of the format. And they're what allow you to gain a mon advantage on blue decks, who normally get a huge mon advantage on everyone else by countering your 8 drop with a 2 mana spell.
Yes.
And I feel that they really are... I was about to say that they're necessary for every red deck. Shame on me. But you should definitely feel good about casting them on blue mages. And I do.
Yeah, I've started including those, in particular in mono red decks. I've started including both of those, Pyroblast and Red Elemental Blast. And even to a lesser extent, I've included, Blue Elemental Blast and Hydro Blast. But it's not as necessary because, as you said, blue has a lot more going forward in terms of counter spells.
Yes, and Cyclonic Rift. And you just probably half the time Pyroblast will counter Cyclonic Rift. It's just...
Yeah, it's a beautiful card.
Yeah.
What I love most about it is sort of in a pinch, you just send an island or a mountain back to their hands.
I think that's actually Volcanic something. You can't actually... those cards don't actually have that ability. You're thinking of Volcanic... Oh, I forget there's a... There's a legend card which is similar to that. I forget the name. But Pyroblast, you can't send actually an island back to their hands.
Aww.
Yeah. Trying to remember what it's called. But yeah, there's a card from Legends which costs 1 red, and it does something similar to what you're thinking, but it's...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I forget what it
is. I like Omen of Fire.
Let's see. What does that card do?
Omen of Fire. It's 3 red instant, return all islands to their owner's hands, and then each player sacrifices a plains or a white permanent for each white permanent he or she controls.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. An alliances card. It has the woman in armor shouting.
I'm trying to think if this is
coming behind her.
Cruel and unusual or absolutely... necessary. that is a spicy one.
That's the kind of cards I like.
Yeah, the problem is my friends don't play any basic lands. So they might not have any islands in play. They're like, okay, to return my tundra. You got me. Excellent. So, Chris Longton also asked, what's the most I've ever spent on a card?
Yeah.
And in terms of Commander, definitely the most I've ever spent is on a From the Vault Nicole Bolas. But then again, that's hardly fair because I didn't have free will and choice when I did that. That was something that I was that was a demand placed upon me by the Elderest Dragon and future ruler of the multiverse. So, Nicole Bolas from the Vault, very expensive, very shiny, very necessary.
Yeah. Do you play other? So, did you build a Grixis deck around him?
Oh, yes.
And what is it?
Well, I did write, I can set in the show notes, an article on Gathering Magic about the Elderest Dragon, Nicole Bolas, and I talk about my strategy, which is very devious.
Of course, and it has to be.
It has to be, yes.
That's awesome. Yeah, so Chris Longton, he asks, what's the most epic political play you've ever pulled off? Was it with Nicole Bolas?
I'm not sure if I know the most epic political play, because it really ought to be somewhere where clearly I was the superior force and I convinced someone to attack the weaker person. I don't remember a specific instance where I did that, but the fact of the matter, it feels like everyone should. So Nicole Bolas, for those who are not aware, it's a 8 mana dragon, and when he attacks someone or whenever he deals damage to someone, they discard their hand. So there's some political work convincing people that this isn't a problem because he costs 8 mana and is eminently fair. So, if I can convince people that I'm in fact just playing a very fair deck and they don't need to worry about me, then I guess I've done a political coup. Actually, no, my strongest political play has to be winning with Slivers Ever, because that just should never happen. If I convince people that I in fact not the most threatening person playing a Slivers deck, I've probably done my job. Because no matter which Slivers variant you're playing, you probably you probably are the most dangerous. I don't know. My win rate with Slivers is insanely high, and it doesn't seem like it should be. I guess my politics when playing Slivers must be just the best. And I kind of talk about how I do this a little bit in my Pain Lands Are Better Than Dual Lands article, yeah, just based on the mono base. I don't want to get into it too much here because, and I haven't written an article about Slivers because I almost feel it's my super secret tech and no one must know, and it's almost too devious to share. I don't know if I want to talk about it.
Have you ever played or played against a Reaper King deck?
Yes, I have. That one's a delight. And I have had someone play Rite of Replication on the Reaper King. Good game. And I think I was playing Sea Monsters too, and I had tapped out.
Oh.
And
don't tap out against Reaper King.
I guess not.
I recognize that sigh.
Yeah, it was the sigh of losing 20 permanents.
Nate again runs the Reaper King deck. That was his first deck, in fact.
Yeah, congrats on getting two new Scarecrows out of Innistrad.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are we going to see more Scarecrows, you think, in Eldritch Moon?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
Or more / effective werewolves.
I don't even know how you could win with werewolves, but it will be interesting to see. I mean, we are definitely owed a werewolf legend at this point.
Yes, we are. But again, so the Commander's Brew did one with, who did they use again? It was a Gruul commander. But Andy tried to put together an effective werewolf deck, and he realized that you just can't. I mean, there are no really effective werewolves.
I don't know how you would do it. It would be an interesting flavor challenge. I think maybe the commander would have to give some very strange direction to the deck, and I feel actually that maybe you wouldn't play too many other werewolves, which is not like a very fun place to be, but it's kind of like the Sea Monsters deck where, like, well, none of these creatures are actually very good, so you have to have some sort of unifying strategy, which is very powerful, and I don't see what that could be yet, but...
Yeah, it has to provide some sort of, not necessarily +1/+1, but an anthem effect, right? And... just something that gives all werewolves some benefit.
Just tribal tech.
Yeah. As he put it, you know, the best werewolf is Chameleon Colossus.
Oh, boy. So, let's see. Azrim asked, if I was on Innistrad, would I be a Google Caller or a Stitcher? Oh, this is a ridiculous question. Of course I'd be a Stitcher. I'm not a fool. I'm not wasting my time with Tutu Zombies when I could create Towering Genius. Next question. Next question.
Let's see. Azrim, that was, when I read it, Azrim, I was sort of disappointed.
So what about equipping boots to commanders without legs? This is another question asked by Merlin.
Yeah, Dirkoke XXL.
So, yeah, I don't do this, to be honest. I don't equip boots to creatures without legs. So, in my Nicol Bolas deck, I don't play any boots. But I do play Clout of the Dominus, which is a hybrid one red slash blue. If a red creature is enchanted, it gains haste. If a blue creature is enchanted, it gains shroud. And I play cards like this, and such as Dragon's Breath and Dragon's Tempest, which are flavorful and nonetheless fulfill some of the same needs. Now, if you're not playing red, it's a little bit harder. But so in the blue deck, I don't actually, in my Thassa deck, I don't play any boots. In part, as I said, because no one creature is necessary, and in part because I don't want to be equipping little boots to my Lorthos, the Tide Maker. That just doesn't make sense. Now, you could try to pitch it to yourself. This is something you could tell yourself at night between bouts of weeping due to your own failures on the flavor level. But you could say that Nicol Bolas is just holding the boots and they're part of his hoard and kind of absorbing the magic of it.
They're kind of like bracelet charms.
I've thought about this, but ultimately I decided that I have dignity and I don't need to be doing this in my casual formats. Now, to each his own or her own, but for me, no boots on creatures without legs.
What about cloaks? Whisper Silk Cloak.
The opportunity hasn't arisen. Like, I haven't had an instance where I felt a strong desire to cloak up something.
Yeah.
Putting a cloak on a dragon would be a little bit silly as well.
It could be a kerchief.
A neckerchief, yeah.
Yeah, or an ascot, right?
Anyways, Kai Chang asks if I use magic for writing inspiration. So,
well, look at you. I love that you're doing this, by the way. You're the first of our guests to actually list the questions and ask them. It's great.
So, the rules of magic and the mechanics and, I guess, the game design of magic have influenced my own writing in the sense that when I'm designing a magic system, I want it to be distinct and have limits to what it can do. And I don't want it to be able to do everything because that makes it feel... So essentially, if I'm writing a plot and the plot is solved through the magic, then the magic has to have limits and you have to be able to... It has to be distinct enough that you can see kind of the evolution of the magic. So if the victory in the fourth act comes from the protagonist using the magic in a new way, or in the turning point to the third act as things start going well due to a change in the magic, then those rules have to be implemented early and talked about and kind of portrayed in a way that the reader can understand. Now, sometimes I will write a story where they do use magic, but it's actually not what solves their problems. And in that case, I don't feel as obligated to put down distinct rules. And sometimes readers still want to know the rules. And sometimes I say, too bad to them. But sometimes I'll list it as well. Even though it's not... you can infer the rules based on what's happening. And then sometimes that is important. And then in that case, the rules need to be very distinct. And then I also think about balancing magics. So in my stories, typically the magic has a cost which is so heinous, you need to sacrifice something so dramatic that I want to make it so a reasonable person could decide in this fantasy rule world that they do not, in fact, want to use a magic. That they decided, well, okay, I'm just actually not going to learn magic. I'm better off without it. So those are two things which I've gotten out of playing magic, a sense for balance and magic design. In fact, now that I've realized it, I don't think I've actually mentioned yet that I am a, or maybe you mentioned it, but I am a fantasy writer. I love carrying people on journeys of imagination. And I have played against Brandon Sanderson, fantasy writer who also plays magic as well. So it is definitely... And also, what I need to mention is that fantasy... magic is a very creative game. It's actually more creative than most fantasy books I read. And just the raw imagination which goes into building the cards and some of just the creative worlds that we've brought... where we come to is an inspiration unto itself. And really, the most important thing to be a, when you're a writer, the most important thing you can do for yourself is read a lot. And in this case, also, when I'm not reading, I play a bunch of Magic primarily, and I soak up that creativity.
Yeah, I have to admit, since I got back into Magic, and especially once I decided to really put effort into podcasting, I label myself a storyteller. Now, I don't write fiction. What I do is I generally assemble a group around a table, and I'll tell stories that way. And we all tell stories, and I have to adapt to it. And I just provide the overarching, oh, I hate that word. I just provide the meta plot points, and then the players will tend to fill it in. And as you can probably tell, I'm a game master.
Yes. Right? By the way, I love the word overarching. Go on.
And what I've done since really putting my effort into podcasting for Magic is I've kind of allowed the role-playing to fall by the wayside, which is really sad. I've had to give up other things in order to make room for podcasting. And, you know, I see my kids once in a while, and we all live in the same house, so it's convenient. But, you know, really, it's that storytelling in Magic through the cards, through the art, even through the mechanics, because they're getting so much better about telling stories through the mechanics. Like, you look at just the two different mechanics that are so similar superficially between Ghoul Caller Geesa and Stitcher Giralf, right? That they're both creating zombies, but they're doing it in entirely different ways that speaks to that flavor and an understanding of who that character is. And I have to give kudos to the entire development team. And I don't just mean the developers, but I mean everybody from they're calling it advanced design teams now, all the way through the creative team.
Mm-hmm.
They tie it together and tell a beautiful story as a result.
Yeah, speaking of Magic story, I am very excited about the story which is going currently on Innistrad, and I'm thrilled to see where that was going. And I do have an exciting announcement to make. I will be writing creative text, flavor text, and word names for an upcoming Magic set.
And, oh, very good.
I can't share anything from that set because I had to swallow an NDA, and if I speak at all towards it, the NDA will hatch inside me and eat me from the inside out.
yes, I know how these things work.
But
it's terrible.
I can confirm that the story is going to get even more delightful. And by delightful, I mean crazy, horrifically, excitingly twisted.
Yes, well, I was going to ask you all sorts of Vorthos questions then, but I'll have to hold off because I don't want to put you in any uncomfortable positions.
Well, I can answer anything about anything except as it relates to, I can't really answer. The thing is, the set I'm working on is so far in the future that I don't think you can even ask a question that will touch on this. But you could probably go ahead and ask. And I won't know anything which is going to relate directly to your current questions.
Well, maybe. It depends on how much of the story it relates to, right? And so I guess, here's where we say, if you want anything edited out, this is where you say, that should be edited out, editor.
Fair enough.
I think, and I realize that Nate thinks I'm a little bit crazy and or gets hopeful when I say this, but I think we're going to see Emrakul in Eldritch Moon, and the Emrakul we see will be Phyrexian tainted and serving as kind of a bus for Phyrexians.
That is pretty epic. So let's see.
Because they have to bring Emrakul back, otherwise they're you know, we will think they are hacks as story writers.
And the recent Magic stories have strongly hinted that Emrakul is coming and coming towards this epicenter of the Drown Yard. We haven't seen any elements to indicate Phyrexia yet. Do you think so? Oh, there was this sign.
Yes.
Have people been talking about signs of Phyrexia?
Well, you look at Root Out. And that has...
Phil's going to pass out the tinfoil hats.
Yes,
right,
I've got mine firmly on now.
you look at Root Out, and Root Out clearly has a Phyrexian symbol in it, and it has it's a perverted Avacyn symbol and with a phi slice through it. Graf Mull has a Phyrexian, has the same symbol behind it, which is clearly a Phyrexian symbol. And there's one other place I can't recall right now where it appears, but then you look at depictions of blood, right, in the set. Now, they're not shy about putting blood where where they need to. And, you know, there are numerous cards we can cite. But then in Shard of Broken Glass, the blood coming off that hand, which is clearly being wielded as clearly rather owned by an insane person, the blood there is black oil. The I forget the name of the card. Is it? It's not Pick Your Brain. There are these three images up above the person's head, and that person is...
It's Pick the Brain.
Pick the Brain. But is it Pick the Brain that has the guy with that's crying oil?
He's got some black stuff.
He does, yeah. I'm looking at it now. Ducks.
Yeah, and so Pick the Brain, and also in Gone Missing, right, there's the tricorn hat floating, which is beautiful, but underneath that tricorn hat is... a face. And maybe this is my brain going into pattern recognition. Nate knows I have a history of assuming conspiracies where there are none. And but there's Gone Missing. But then the greatest poster child of this theory of all is Avison herself, whose eyes turn black, who in the anguished unmaking art clearly has Phyrexian tears, Phyrexian markings under her eyes in the classic, what is it, Onslaught Invasion? What's the set with the Phyrexian mask? But that Phyrexian mask with the black tears coming off of the eyes is classic. Every time you see Phyrexia, it's accompanied by those. And then the set symbol itself, we haven't talked about this, Nate. The set symbol itself has the little ends are really symmetrically pointed on little flanges that come off of the set symbol. And if you look at the set symbol, it's kind of penetrating that circle in a very slashy way. And I think that's going to morph into a Phyrexian-like symbol for the next set.
And that means you won't be able to play any of the cards from the next set, Phil.
Well, there are always cards that oppose the Phyrexians, Nate. Always cards that oppose the Phyrexians.
Well, that was a beautiful theory. Let's see. I have heard a previous theory that Nicol Bolas is maneuvering things in order to pit the Eldrazi against the Phyrexians. However, two of the Eldrazi are now dead, so I'm no longer sure that plan was viable, if it was ever his plan.
Well, it could be his plan was foiled.
It could be. It could be by those meddlesome kids at the Gatewatch.
That's right. And they didn't even mean to foil his plans. They were just protecting some lame plane.
So it is interesting to think about how Avison was corrupted. And I'm not sure we know fully how all the details yet. Once she was corrupted in the story, she has there's like a blast which hits her. So it is... She's not, like, in contact with any oil or anything like that.
Yeah, we don't know what that boy was.
We don't know what the what was?
In the fiction, she rescued some child from the woods, brought it back to the mother, and that's when the buzzing started.
I think that it was almost when she was airborne. So I don't think she was necessarily in contact with the boy. I may be misremembering that, but I don't think...
Oh, infections take time to spread, A.E.
Yes, but it felt very much like a single... moment event, which is a blast.
Yeah.
And now I may be projecting a little bit because I play Nicol Bolas as an Outer Dragon commander, and I feel that sort of psychic devastation is more indicative of Nicol Bolas. Now, there's a lot of, but also there's conflicting image here that when this blast happened, I'll call it a blast because we're doing this, she had a vision of what seemed like Nahiri's stones swirling around in a way which is indicative of Nahiri. So it's possible that if Nahiri, on the other hand, like corrupting angels and making their mind change, this isn't something I necessarily expect Nahiri to do. But maybe if Nahiri has some control over Emrakul, or Emrakul has some control over Nahiri, or maybe Nahiri, Emrakul, and Nicol Bolas are all holding hands and spinning around in a merry circle, that I suspect that it's some combination of those. So that's the sort of conspiracy theory that I'm on.
Yeah. So I think Nicol Bolas is definitely arranging things, kind of nudging them in the background, sometimes taking a direct hand, as we saw with Ugin, which I don't want to go into that. But what I think happened is Nahiri has been luring Emrakul from plane to plane and lured, and Nahiri, through all of her travels with Sorin and so forth, knew about the Phyrexian menace and has brought Emrakul to New Phyrexia, where Emrakul was infected in some way we will see eventually, and then lured her back to Innistrad.
So my current understanding is that based on the Sorin chapter, Magic Story by Ari Levitch on Sorin, that it's my current theory is that Nahiri is summoning Emrakul to Innistrad in order to make Sorin fulfill his promise to help fight Eldrazi. So I didn't really understand how her motive.
I like that.
I couldn't understand how her motive worked initially, but I think that is what it is. So she's not doing it to be mean, and she's not doing it because she is abandoning Zendikar, which is a point I didn't understand before. But she's in fact trying to save Zendikar by diverting Emrakul to a different plane, one where Sorin is, and then he'll help her defeat it, or he'll defeat it in some way.
Yeah.
It could be certainly a lot of rage in there as well, and it could be, and I do suspect that Nicol Bolas had something to do with it, mainly because I suspect Nicol Bolas has something to do with everything. He's been a long-standing villain of the arch nemesis of the Magic Multiverse for some time. Yeah. Definitely a character I really enjoy. But also, he's been mentioned multiple times in recent Magic stories, so the fact that they are continuing to kind of inject him in the backgrounds, keeping us aware of this menace.
Hey, remember this guy.
He does support my theories that he is doing something. And his style is to never be the one doing anything himself, but controlling people who do.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely. And you can use him as kind of the ultimate, what is it, the mastermind, even as you bring forward horrible menaces like the Eldrazi and Phyrexia. Phyrexia can be manipulated to Bolas's will.
And let's not forget, the Eldrazi came out directly because of Nicol Bolas's manipulating. He's the one who brought Jace and Sarkhan and Chandra to the same place, which broke the containment in the eye. So he is directly the cause of everything which happened in Zendikar.
That's right. And the only real question I have is whether he did that to eliminate the Phyrexian menace, or did that as a distraction from the Phyrexian menace.
Yeah.
I mean, he is ultimately threatened by Phyrexia as well.
I don't know. I'm not even sure.
Unless he seeks to be the new Yawgmoth.
I don't know what his goal is, actually.
Mm.
And that is exciting. Stay tuned.
Will we see a 2-mana, 1-black, or maybe a 2-mana, 1-hybrid, red-blue-black Bolas's Will card?
Nope.
I'm not sure. Some people have talked to me about recreating Bolas as a card. I'm not sure what they'll do with that. The original Nicol Bolas Planeswalker is played a lot in these cube formats, and he's very well-loved. So it's possible they will just reprint that card because it's just so evocative and it's pretty good, but they might print another one.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure if we see him back, if we see him as a Planeswalker again, it'll be a different one. I was just sort of referring to Yawgmoth's will there.
Oh,
trying to set himself up as the new Yawgmoth.
So, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure his goal. His goal is definitely to do something. I'm not sure we have evidence that he wants to be the lord of everything yet. Maybe so. He's definitely wants to control everything.
He wants to control everything.
He may not care about the day-to-day rulership. He's probably fine letting other people do that.
Oh, I agree. I mean, Yawgmoth had his praetors, right?
That's true. And damn fine ones, too.
Yeah, the new breed is much better in terms of their effectiveness than their old. I mean, Gix was some lame-o flesh bag at this point.
They definitely don't say it. They wouldn't not stand up to Emrakul, I'll tell you that right now.
It is true. Ooh, Emrakul, Praetor of Phyrexia. What do you think, Nate?
No. No.
I'm not sure your tinfoil hat was as tightly secured to your head as needed be, Philip, but I won't hold it against you. That's fine.
Yeah, I don't, obviously not a Praetor.
The set has a lot of ambiguity designed into it. And I think that's a strength of the current writing. I think a strength of the current writing and the current set is that they allow us these theories, and they allow us these. They haven't ruled out all the options yet. We still have this chance to speculate, and that's exciting. That's definitely not something we've had before in the Magic story.
Yeah, it's neat. They've really activated it. That's kind of the way I look at it. You know, like TV shows take a little while, or different types of media take a little while before they actually activate a storyline. The Forgotten Realms in the 2000s, for example. Never mind. But that all then they've really kind of activated the story by making it a continuous story that goes from block to block. And fortunately, we have Jace to keep it all, you know, tie it all together.
Mm.
Jackie, one of our $10 patrons, actually, she asks, are you as tired of Jace as the rest of us?
Well, that is an interesting question. For one, I think actually Jace's character is very, very well written and a very interesting character. If you're not familiar with the background, I suggest you do read the story by Kelly Diggs, I think. Jace's origin story on the Magic website. Do read it. Fundamentally, he has lost all his childhood memories. And that makes for a very interesting character. He has a hard time relating to other people. And he feels very isolated from everyone.
So in other words, he's a typical Magic player.
Oh, yeah. Well, in some respects, but most of us remember our first pet, first hug, first smile from our mother. And he doesn't have any of that. So what he does instead is ruins people's dreams by bouncing creatures back to their hands. So that's all he has left to him. He has this one thing, and that is just absolutely devastating people's wallets and them in games. GP Albuquerque.
And saying no.
GP Albuquerque, someone ultimated Jace against me, and that kind of is indicative of how my sealed deck went at GP Albuquerque. And it was not a good feeling, but Jace is very strong. And so how do I feel about Jace? Her question was, how do I feel about Jace? I'm all for him. Certainly very strong and interesting and dynamic character.
How many Jace I do we have, Nate?
Seven.
Seven.
Feels like more, doesn't it? Feels like
it does.
It feels like an interminable number.
Just so Jackie can know where we are, I have just told you I asked the Jace question.
Very good.
And, she asked another one. What's a card you find yourself using but never really see other people use, besides Leviathans?
This feels a little bit more like the pet card. I don't have an...
Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, I have one. And that would be Assault Suit. I put it in the Grim deck. I think it's actually as good as a sword, one of the swords of Fire and Ice and such, in Commander. And it costs 25 cents based on
a set
of $25. And I feel that it is underused.
Mm-hmm.
With Grim equipped with Assault Suit, basically, it's going to be just devastate the game.
Yeah.
Even more than a sword would, I feel, but it costs more than a sword to equip, so I think that's fair.
Nate, do you run Assault Suit in Grimgrin?
I run it in Phage the Untouchable, and I know you run it in Zergo Helm Smasher.
Yep, Zergo Smash, one of the decks I recently updated to Shadows over Innistrad.
Well, very wise, very wise.
I've been tempted to run it in a couple of other decks, but usually the commanders are facilitating damage as opposed to being the direct cause of it.
Yeah, such as in Xenagos. I don't use it there either.
Right, no. And you never want Xenagos to be a creature.
No.
Never.
No, yeah. I learned that after playing some while. But yeah, I don't try to make Xenagos a creature anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It makes them too vulnerable, and then your whole strategy falls apart.
Yeah.
Wow. So how did you... Now, you're the first person we've had on who... writes flavor text and creates names for the cards, because that's part of it. You'll be creating names or recommending names and recommending flavor text. How did you get into that position?
So two components. One,
and the NDA is lurking right next to you.
So I can tell you two things, and that is, one, I wrote something which felt like it had something to do with that. So I've been writing on Gathering Magic. I did some flavor reviews where I talked about flavor text and crave text in a kind of a joking sort of fashion. And then I wrote on Gathering Magic in general. And that's something that they could see and have as a stepping point.
Yeah, they're very flavorful and entertaining articles.
Thank you. That's part of the component. Or that's one thing. And another thing, you should need to talk to someone who works at Wizards of the Coast. Maybe message me and I could suggest a name, but it is you just need to talk to someone who works at Wizards of the Coast. And both those things, not necessarily easy, but that's how it is.
No, yeah, I've heard
James Pianca
on Command Zone. He described the process, and it's really an entertaining system too. He described it as kind of a gamified system of three recommendations for names and three recommendations for flavor text. And you can either do them all at once and serve as, you know, and basically be first in, or you can kind of lurk and watch what other people do and then dive in before the deadline. And it would be interesting to have an after conversation with you and see which of those techniques you adopted.
It would. Well, I don't actually. I think I will not be talking about any of that sort of stuff, I'm afraid. But that I think basically the only thing I can share about that process, from what I understand and what I understand of the set, or what I can share about the set, is just heavy breathing. Just this experience is going to be really fun and exciting. But yeah.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's cool. Oh, awesome. Okay, trying. I'll do my best not to think of the elephant in the room now.
Yeah, it is difficult because, again, I essentially cannot answer any of them.
Well, Lynn, let's talk about a topic that you are very comfortable talking about. Your cosplay as Giraffe, and we'll lead it off with James Brooke Ray, who is a dumb red player on Twitter. For your Stitcher cosplay, how long did you work on it? And are there any pieces of it that you made specifically from scratch?
So I made the operative monocle from scratch, or as a layman might call it, the goggle, singular. I made that from scratch. Well, I fusing several components together, as I'm wont to do.
Sure.
Then I had minions. Stitcher Geralf always has laboratory assistants help with the apron and the surgical gown.
Oh, so someone donated their blood to the apron?
It's not really a donation. I paid them good coin of the realm for their donation. But yeah, there are ways that people you can hire to help you make a costume. And it is a little bit, that stage is a little bit overwhelming for me, since I have no natural craftiness and no patience to learn. So that does make it difficult. But there is recourse. For me, what gets me excited about is cosplaying in character. So I spend time thinking about what I'm going to say and thinking about the character. And that's the spot where I want to demonstrate that's where I really demonstrate my creativity and what I'm enthusiastic about. Whereas other cosplayers, I perceive as what they're more excited about is the cosplay itself. And that's very fair. For instance, Mel Lee just made a cosplay of Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas. And she has lights in it, and just this crazy, amazing cosplay suit of Tezzeret, and that's just fantastic. That's just amazing.
That's crazy.
You should be able to find that online.
Yeah. Nate is...
To the show notes. Nate, to the show notes. Nate, we'll have a link
Nate
for that
Nate is faster
well.
At this than I am. He's already included at least the reference, so we can go find it again. And so, why? That's the question. And then I have some other questions following up. But why cosplay at all? Why, and specifically, why Giraffe?
So cosplay is like wearing imagination on your sleeve. It allows you to celebrate a fandom you're excited about in a visual way that other people can connect to.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all reasons to cosplay. And, you know, I had been playing Magic for 20 years, and I decided I was gonna strut it. I was going to show it. And that's why when I saw Stitcher Giraffe specifically, I do have a few other cosplays, but... I'll be wearing Stitcher Geralf more than all the rest put together, especially during these Shadows of Innistrad releases. Him specifically, I feel that people are too afraid of science in general, things that they don't understand, and he kind of represents that fear in the sense that the Dr. Frankenstein-type characters represent our fear of the unknown, our fear of science getting ahead of ourselves and creating things which are ethically unsound and unevil.
It goes back to the very, very roots of Frankenstein.
Indeed. But in this case, and in case of science overall, it has a potential, but it also is our greatest opportunity to excel as human beings and advance society and lift us up. So I think in general, people overestimate the downsides of science and underestimate the benefits to them as people. And I think it's important when I'm cosplaying Stitcher Geralf, I'm very aware of that. I'm kind of you know, in a joking way, making fun of mad science, making, but also touching on the fears people have of science, but also encouraging people to appreciate science and understand that it can be used for the better.
So you are not worried about science running amok and scientists playing God and turning away from the one true God, the Gitrog monster?
You know, I hadn't considered those people who really are sensitive over issues of the Gitrog monster and rather other, wouldn't want science to detract from that devotion. But no, I think, you know what? If someone has to be leading us the way, leading the way to a new future, it's better scientists than, say, angels with blood streaked over their bodies, or Gitrog monsters, or
politicians
and plutocrats. So I would like to see scientists have, you know, perhaps you don't want scientists to be digging in graveyards, and even though clearly it doesn't harm anyone to do that because they're already dead, but you don't want scientists to be doing certain things, so they could be supervised. But I think too often people, in this, even in this day and age, are restricting science, you know, cutting funding from science, when it's really the greatest avenue for progress. And the people who typically have a greatest understanding of what's going on in the world within their field.
So you're going on record and saying that we should be led by science and scientists who embrace science, as opposed to entitled plutocrat politicians like Sorin, or even benevolent and beneficent entities such as the frog god of Gitrog, who listens to everything.
I am going on record saying that Sitra Jerolf, greater to have him have free license to do things on Innistrad than having cultists of the Gitrog monster be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely going on record saying that.
Wow. Those are bold words. Yeah. That's a brave statement.
So we're not allowed to have politics on this episode, so I apologize for that.
I think our foray into politics and religion is almost over, because it's very possible that the Gitrog monster has not actually heard your words yet, so it's best we don't say them too often.
Yes, that's true.
Besides, I think he is listening. Holy smokes. Nate put Mel Lee's Tezzeret into the show notes,
good.
And that's fantastic. And she's clearly up against a green screen and it's been composited, but you saw this in person?
No, but costume? There's a cosplay group on Facebook where she posted this.
So let's say one's asset is a salt and pepper, kind of maybe reddish beard with a little point and a handlebar mustache. Who should that person cosplay from Magic's history?
Grenzo.
Nate, are you going to cosplay for Gapla?
Oh, I doubt it.
You won't be wearing your little devil horns?
Nah.
It's not a clear match, but there's a character called Boris Devilboon from Legends.
Yes, there is.
Whom no one would ever recognize.
No.
But the one person who does recognize it. So this is what I found in cosplay. You can cosplay one of the big five planeswalkers. Then everyone will know who you are. Sort of. They'll often recognize you. But if you cosplay as a more minor character, fewer people will recognize you immediately, but those who do will be extra enthusiastic about it. For instance, everyone knows who Jace is, and if you cosplay as someone with Jace, they'll be somewhat excited. But if someone plays...
Jace is Gavin Verhey.
Yes. If someone cosplays as Boris Devilboon, the one person at the convention who recognizes you will be incredibly excited and just be blown away and be very enthusiastic. So it's hard to say you're incorrect. Like multiplayer casual format, you're definitely not incorrect to cosplay as Boris Devilboon, because if that's what is fun for you, you should definitely go for it. Even if people don't immediately recognize who you are, if you don't have a lot of as powerful a visual representation, for instance.
Tybalt the Fiend-Blooded does have a pointy beard, but he has no mustache.
Tybalt is another strong choice. But yeah, I also recommend cosplayers wear the card. I think almost all the time you should do this. If you're one of the big five planeswalkers, maybe you don't need to wear the card. But even then, you can wear the card specifically of the cosplay of the planeswalker version that you're cosplaying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you probably should do that, even if you're like, well, clearly everyone will know this cosplay on site immediately. I don't think that's necessarily true. Even if you've done a great job, even in Mel Lee's cosplay, you could wear the card and just so people are absolutely sure. This happens in writing too. In writing, you can set things up so people have every reason to understand what's going on. They can infer what's going on in the scene. They can infer what's speaking, whom's speaking. However, if you don't make it crystal clear, such as through a dialogue tag or through wearing a card, they'll have like a 5% doubt or 10% doubt. And that will be enough to keep them from like walking up and talking to you or for having the positive interaction that really you can have a lot of when you're cosplaying. So I do recommend cosplayers wear the card that they're cosplaying, because at the least, then people can walk up, look at the card, and start a conversation with you.
Do you recommend wearing the card like as a pocket square or as a lanyard ID badge?
I guess that depends.
Well, if you're a scientist, you'd use it as a pocket square, would you?
That'd be good. I have it pinned to my apron.
All right.
If you see any of my cosplayers' pictures to the show notes, you'll see the card actually pinned to my apron, and it's a very forgivable thing. It's like a dialogue tag in writing. It's there, and it's just kind of a way to reassure people and make sure everyone's on the same page and there's no uncertainty.
Right.
Even if there's no reason to be uncertain. Like you can prove through writing or like clearly this person is one who's speaking because of X, Y, and Z, or clearly this is this cosplay because of X, Y, and Z, but still, better to remove all uncertainty in terms of in-person interactions, at least.
Yeah, it's true. You make a lot of assumptions that because you have all the information, other people have all the information, and that just isn't true.
Yeah, well, they do have all the information, but, you know, as I say, just even if there's 5% uncertainty there, that can actually be a drop of poison in the rain barrel, which makes everything just a little uncomfortable.
Now, I'm very conscious of not taking all of your time, although I suspect we're going to be talking for hours at Kapla. Nate will have a flask, I assume. I think I will have a flask. So maybe there will be some libation shared. But it is almost the end of the show, because we're approaching the two-hour mark. Can you believe that? We've talked about what makes decks fun. We've talked about absolutes and card choices. Oh, what's your favorite? I mean, you're playing a lot of blue, but what's your favorite guild color combination? I mean, you can approach this both mechanically and Vorthosian.
Yeah, it's Simic overall, as you might have guessed. Just they have the same appreciation for exploration and delving into the mysteries of life.
Mm-hmm.
And then my secondary choice is Golgari. So I don't, and then, and it is it, to be fair. So I have a lot of favorite guilds. Simic a little bit more than.
Yeah, so your first two being Simic and Golgari, you have a very life death theme going on, don't you?
Well, I mean, in Golgari, yes. Just it's the same idea that you're recycling unneeded dead bodies to create new life. Well, I mean, who could object to that?
And Simic is a celebration of life, the very foundation of life itself.
New life, no matter how many gelatinous limbs it has.
That's excellent. Do you style yourself a green player?
As
in the green approach.
To what I do reference, I will reference other podcasts here. Let's see. Planeswalker's Guide. I did a podcast and I talk about how in some ways I'm a red player. But as we've talked about today as well, have a lot of blue ideology and a lot of blue ways of thinking and a lot of black ways of thinking. And that just kind of is indicative of how long I've played the game. So for different times in the game,
right,
different colors have spoken to me.
Yeah.
I guess even for a while, white spoke to me in terms of playing white cards. But for the most part, I think white is an abysmal color. I just hate it so much.
Yeah, I look back. I took a break of about 17 years between what amounts to Fallen Empires and 2013. And I look at myself kind of as a green player. Now, we're all blue because we're, you know, Magic is a very thoughtful game. You have to think about the strategy and making decisions. And so that's inherently kind of a blue concept. But in terms of the way it manifests in the game, with my background blue filtered out, I stand out as very green, right? I like big creatures that punch things. And that makes me a Timmy as well. But whatever I do, it tends to be all about big creatures hitting my opponents, and not in tricky ways, not, you know, a kind of a Nekusar way where it grinds you down over time with card draw and all sorts of stuff. Straight up, green trample. I'm happy with a Terastodon. I'm happy with a Primordial Hydra. Boom.
Yeah, more power to you. Gotta love the fatties.
Nate, you should ask this next one.
Which Hogwarts house would you consider yourself a member of?
Definitely the Ravenclaw. If we had been in charge, Harry Potter had been a Ravenclaw, we would have taken us 7 books to get things done. We would have done the research, found out how to destroy Lord Voldemort quickly, and you know what? Not without so much pretense about it. It's just that's what knowledge does for you. And really, you can hire someone to be courageous. You need to be the source of the driving force, and that is Ravenclaw and our knowledge.
So you've taken requisite tests for that, or do you self-identify?
I've done the research.
That's excellent.
So you hire Gryffindor minions.
Yep.
They don't have to be Gryffindor. They could be Slytherin.
If anything, perhaps Slytherin be more dependable. You know their motives. They're more predictable.
Yeah. Whereas Slytherin, you know they're going to turn on you. Just it's a matter of when.
You can depend on them being on your side until it serves them otherwise.
That's right. So we now have competing questions about Planeswalker buddies. I say competing, but I should really say complimentary. So we'll ask the one by Renat first, who is at the Twisted Light. Also from Russia, by the way, as far as I know, our only Russian listener. There are probably more, but who knows. He says, you are stranded in a bar on an unknown plane. Which planeswalker / legend will be your drinking buddy? It's an unknown plane.
Oh, this question. So, first of all, it wouldn't be in a bar. It would be somewhere romantic, you know, like a graveyard with little witch lights swirling around, you know, somewhere to set the mood. And I think it would be Liliana Vest. I think that character is very interesting. Like Jace, she has a troubled past. Her character has intrinsic conflict to it in the sense that she tried to rescue her brother using, dark magic, killed him instead, turned him into a zombie, sent his spirit to an eternity of torment in the abyss. So she has something of a troubled past. But what she's done with this is she's kind of made herself a little unfeeling just to get over this, and she's now committed herself to doing what she needs to do to survive and become more powerful, and she's kind of sloughed off society's notions of what she should do and what's right, and instead is doing what she enjoys and, more to the point, what she needs. And even if that's, she's gone beyond selling her soul to demons, she's now killing the demon she sold her soul to gain her power back, her autonomy back. And that she's definitely taking things to the next level. And I definitely appreciate that and commend that.
And so you'd have a lot to talk about with her.
Yes. Or I like to think so. Or I would hopefully survive her presence. I have high aspirations for surviving the encounter.
Yeah. I mean, if Jace can survive an encounter with her, you could survive it.
I like to think so.
I mean, at the very least, you could talk about the art of raising zombies and your appreciation of that art.
That's true. And, and manipulating people through commander decks. So, there we go.
Now, friend of the show, Nick Jaragoski asks, who is also a new father, by the way, new father of Jackson Jaragoski. He says, said buddy is a lightweight and passes out after one margarita. Whoa, do you think Liliana would pass out after one margarita? A pair of goblins begins to heckle you. So you tell a yo mama joke. Turns out she was the mama to every goblin there. And so which planeswalker do you choose to save your bacon and why? Now, Liliana ain't going to save you.
It is hard to fathom Liliana drinking more than she can hold. But it is possible that she's having a delirious episode based on her use of the chain veil. That I could accept. Who do I then call? Which planeswalker? I think I would definitely want to call Karn Liberated, the Silver Golem. Oh. I just can depend on him straightening things out. I don't know if he'd necessarily save Liliana, but he would probably be neutral towards her, as you could kind of expect him to be. And he is another kind of iconic character to the Magic universe who has really stood the test of time, similar to Nicol Bolas in that sense.
Well, you would call on him even though he has a proven track record of fatally corrupting entire planes with Phyrexian taint?
Look, everyone makes mistakes. Can't we allow one person one plane that they destroy?
There's more planes.
Yeah, there are. There are always more planes.
I don't think we've ever asked this. In both of you, actually, and this is just coming to me. How would you destroy a plane?
Nate?
We know of at least two methods.
I think Nate would destroy it using his Eldrazi hordes that he's cheated into play using, that polymorphist.
I do that a lot with a lot of characters.
Well, it's more that you conquer the plane, but your Eldrazi hordes do destroy it, don't they?
Well, they destroy your side of it.
I think I would prefer to control the plane through my benevolent machinations.
Excellent. All right. Now, A.E., I should have asked you at the beginning. May I call you A.E.?
You may.
Okay, very good.
I deign that you can call me. Yes, I'll allow it. I'll allow it.
We'd have to go back and edit everything to Mr. Marling, and that would be... I'm joking.
It's the third. Mr. Marling the third.
Oh, is it really?
No.
Okay, A.E. the third.
No.
There you go.
No, no.
But we could start something here. Oh.
Grand Arbiter Marling the third.
Now, did I think you mentioned when we were first talking about this that you wanted to have a special contest for our listeners. Is that right?
Good question, Phil. So, on the subject of magic and writing, certainly, I do have a new release called Magic Banquet, and I think I will have a giveaway, and if you are a listener who has made this far, you deserve the chance to win a free copy of Magic Banquet. To win it, send me through Twitter, or possibly through another avenue if you know me through another social media outlet. Send to me your fun philosophy that you use for any one commander deck. So tell me in a sentence what makes this commander deck fun to you, and probably list the commander as well. Then I'll take these, and I will select a random one, and then I'll send you a paperback of Magic Banquet, and Magic Banquet is a delightful story. I tend to write what I think of as the furthest shore of fantasy. So this one is, imagine dragon steaks, ambrosia, and chimera stew. The Magic Banquet is to die for, they say. And they are right. One guest perishes each night. The street waif Aja just wants a few mouthfuls of the first course, but this is a party not so easily left. So this is just one of the, I tend to think of the most crazy thought premise I can imagine, then make a story based off that and have a lot of fun
with it. Wow. And what was your inspiration for this one? I mean, that is pretty crazy. How did you come up with that?
Well, it was honestly, it was probably reading some of the magical feasts of Harry Potter. I was just like, this is ridiculous. Excellent. These food descriptions go on and on and on, and I'm going to make that relevant. So, in the Magic Banquet, they have 13 courses, and each one is of the food has some sort of magical component in, and typically there's also something dangerous about it, and they have to figure out how to eat this course in a way which allows them to survive. And bad manners will get you killed, and then the chef kind of tells the guests how to eat them correctly, the courses correctly, but he does it in a tricky, nefarious way. So each course is something of a riddle.
Oh, and if you eat it improperly, then there are consequences.
Yes. Some case That's you might... Lovely. Yeah, well, let's see. For instance, if you eat the chimera stew in the incorrect way, you'll start changing into different animals. And then later on, it gets even more dangerous.
Nate, does this remind you of any place?
It's like Captain Crunch when you tears up the upper palate of your mouth. Yeah.
Yes. 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 Just like that. But in a fantasy setting, yes. But you were absolutely correct. But I would argue there may not be a right way to... Is there a right way to eat Captain Crunch? Because there is a right way to eat these fantasy banquet meals. So I guess you have to have Captain Crunch soak for an hour until the cereal is...
Yeah, but then it's not crunchy anymore. So, it's just Captain.
Yeah. That's, now I'm sad.
You use your back teeth.
Because I'm sad because I realize that sometimes there is no right way to do things, and our childhood was a torment of bad decisions. So...
I'm actually looking at it on Amazon right now. We'll provide the show link in our show notes. That's one thing I wanted to remind folks. When we say in the show notes, we actually, a lot of people don't realize this. We have a fully functional website where we post a synopsis of what we talked about. Sometimes we talk about the cards and we put the cards in there. So all of these links to AE's books and articles and several other places we'll get to in just a moment, I'm sure he'll name. It's on the website. And of course, the website is commanderinmtg.com. So head over there.
Excellent. There, they'll be fine. Be able to find a link to my articles on gathering magic as well, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yes.
And you'll find a link to my Twitter feed. That's where I talk about magic cards primarily. Yes. That's AE Marling. And that's it. And problem solved. Well, yeah. No underscores or anything.
Yeah, I know. That's so easy to type in. What we are going to do, rather, is we've got links to Gathering Magic, your Twitter account, the Amazon author page, your blog as well, and your Facebook page.
All right.
How about that?
Well, now I'm feeling a little paranoid, but I guess that's to be expected.
Well,
they're all looking at me.
I actually downloaded, when we first met, I downloaded Brood of Bones, but I may have mentioned a certain magic addiction, and so I haven't actually read it yet, although I'm curious to find out how Hiresha got her curse. And Nate, your wife Chris is reading as well?
My wife and I share a Kindle account, and my latest book choice has been a downer in her opinion, so she is starting Your Works with the book that she deemed had the cutest cover art.
Would that be Fox's Bride?
Which is, of course, Fox's
Good
Bride.
Choice.
And I've heard her giggle three times in the first hour of reading.
I'm glad to hear that. the Fennec Fox is very similar to a kitten in size, but its ears are as large as like an adult fox. So it's mainly ears by body weight. It's like 30% ears. Some people own fennec foxes as pets. It's probably not a good idea. They're very squirrely, hard to control. It's not really a tamed animal as a species, and they're illegal in California. However, they are adorable, so I had to write a story with them. And this uncontrolled, uncontained sort of creature, when given universal power in an Egyptian sort of setting, is the premise of Fox's Bride. So it's a delight. So she's probably made a good choice.
Huh. And AE, as we said, we'll list all of these places people can find you, and they will be very near the top of the show notes to make it much easier. Our deck lists, of course, are up on deckstats.net. You can probably tell this by now, AE, but we love interacting with our listeners. There's nothing we enjoy more than chatting with them. We're constantly chatting with them on our deck playtest group. We have a Patreon chat for the $10 and above donors, constantly bouncing ideas off of each other. And you heard Jackie's questions earlier. And of course, they've helped with some actual show planning, and they have access to the show notes too. As we record this, there are a couple of people watching. And so please, folks, if you like what you hear, drop by, let us know. We especially want to hear from you. But if you can take the time to give us a 5-star review on iTunes, we'd be much obliged. And really, if you really, really like the show, even just a dollar a show or one-third a cup of coffee at our patreon.com/commanderandmtg page. That would be very helpful. We're sending messages out and including patrons in some of our future show planning.
I am very much in favor of supporting the artists you love.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are happy that you came on the show, ecstatic. I mean, again, it just took too long to do it, but hopefully it won't take this long. And maybe, just maybe, if you can tell us after it happens what set you've contributed to in terms of flavor text, as long as it's not too far off, you let us know and we'll have you back on.
Oh, I won't be able to shut up about it. Don't you worry.
Excellent. Excellent. So our theme song was created for the podcast by Nate. Our logo was created for the podcast by Mr. Picto and by Kelly. Special thanks to our tech whizzes, Jesse Thompson and Graham Frank, and to Justin for his server space. And of course, special thanks to all of our patrons on Patreon. You've heard some of them today, and we'll do a list when we'll actually list some more names when we have a little bit more time. You can reach us by going to our website, which is commanderandmtg.com. That's where all those show notes are and all those links to AE's content. So if you don't want to Google search A.E. Marling, M-A-R-L-I-N-G, then just go to our website and click on all the links we provide. You can find us on all the social media, again, by searching for Commander and MTG Podcast. And individually on Twitter, I'm at Ketjack.
I'm at Mr. Plorg.
Sean, who is not here, is at Copain26. Send all complaints to at Copain26 on Twitter. And A.E., would you mind taking us out by saying, and that's our show?
And that's our show, and thank you for having me.
Is there any chance at all we can get a one for science out of you?
Well, look.
If you have the energy.
It is important that everyone understand that there's really one driving force of good in this world, and that is science.
Beautiful.